Judiciary Committee to order, and we're going to start on the work session dealing with 2278. I understand that the Fire District 10 folks, Portland, et cetera, all have some kind of tentative agreement of some sort. So if you all want to come on up here, we'll chat. Everybody who wants to chat.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Manton with the City of Portland, Office of Management and Finance. And yes, yesterday afternoon, Senator Ferriola asked us to get together and see if we could come up with some kind of a solution. We pushed around a number of alternatives, and eventually the one that everybody seemed to agree on was one that would take the current unfunded liability of $70.8 million. And go back and look at what the original unfunded liability was in 1984 and assign that liability of $15.5 million in 1984 to the City of Portland. The rest of the liability would then, to the largest degree, be socialized with a few small changes. One, Fire District 10 would pay $50,000 towards that liability of funds that they believe that they can cover. Secondly, the other cities, Gresham, Fairview, Wood Village, and Troutdale, would pay double the socialized cost so that they would have a larger payment than anybody else within the state, with the exception of Portland and Fire District 10. That would cover the cost of the whole problem and would be rolled into rates in the future.
And, Mr. Chairman, Portland would have a piece of the socialized cost as well.
Exactly. Thank you, Senator Ferriola.
So the alternatives that we faced were that if we were not to be able to come to some kind of an agreed solution, the likely outcome would be that the whole of the cost would be socialized. So this seemed to be a much better alternative, and it does some ascription of liability. All of the participants participate financially in helping to erase the liability, and then the remainder is what is put back into the system, essentially to be covered by the contingency.
Okay.
We also intend to draft this with the help of the Legislative Council so that it is not a precedent setting, but a one-time fix for a one-time situation.
All right. The cities of Wood Village, Fairview, Troutdale, they've been contacted.
Senator, I believe that they have Terry.
Senator Terry McCall, Finance Director from City of Gresham. Yes, last night the League of Oregon Cities sent the other cities an email on this. They're probably just opening them now and can't get down here for the session, but they're aware of this. And if I might add, while Gresham, and I know at least one of the other cities, feels that they don't owe anything extra, I believe that I can gain my council and key policymakers' understanding on this, and I believe that I can gain their acceptance for it. And I do want to thank the City of Portland for its generous offer.
All right. Good. Thank you. How long, Mr. Hendricks, do you think it would take to draft this?
Chairman, as members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. This alone won't take long. It's the other things that are going on that I'm also working on that people are trying to get today as well. By the end of the day, I think I could get it to you. But I'm not sure. I still haven't talked to PERS about the specifics of the language, and I would like to make sure they're comfortable with whatever we come up with.
All right.
I presume we'll still be here tomorrow.
I think that's a reasonably safe assumption.
Tomorrow would be a more comfortable time.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not here tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, the logistics, in my opinion, Mr. Hendricks drafting a dilemma with other issues, the direct feedback from the other cities, I would think that Friday would be midday would be probably the earliest we could have everybody on board, and that would leave some time, I believe, during the weekend or first part of next week to close on a draft everybody agrees upon and ask for expedited processing through the system.
Senator Walker.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think I'd go so far as to take it into the first part of next week. I think we could close down by the weekend. So I think we're stretching it.
Let me, I think we'll recess the committee today and come back at 5 p.m. And we may not have the amendment drafted. I know there are other pressures on you. We'll see if we can. If not, we'll adjourn and set a time, I think, 8:30 Friday morning. But I'll try to shoot for today if we can and tax. Well, Mr. Hendricks, I have a lot of pressure on him.
We will do the best we can, Chairman.
I appreciate it. We want it right rather than hurried, obviously. We want to make sure.
Yeah, one of the other players here who would be important to see it, I think, would be Mark Johnson, PERS actuary, to make sure he's comfortable with how it's all going to work.
Okay, great.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then we'd expect to hear, I hope, when we reconvene from all the small cities, from PERS actuarial, and then the last brick in the wall, I guess, would be the language.
All right. Anybody else want to chat about this particular thing? Paul?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Maria Keltner from Local Government Personnel Institute had a conflict and asked me to sit in the event that this came up. I understand that our position is to oppose socialization. I understand that's apparently the default position, but I'd like to find out more about why that's the default position before we reach a conclusion that this is something that we'd support. Because, personally, the cities, the state of Oregon, other counties, all other PERS employers had no involvement in this whatsoever, had no way to find out that anything was going on, and nothing that could have been done about it. And I appreciate the committee's intent to be sure that this is not a precedent-setting response in the event that it is pursued, but it's a difficult situation for all the other PERS employers to be in.
Mr. Chairman, I think that testimony is absolutely on point. The work group discussed the issue. We all agree that it does shift burdens. There's no doubt about that. The only two observations that I'll share, one is that certainly the creation of the contingency fund and the order of Judge Lipscomb to fund it has implications that there would be some contingencies wherein the fund would be used. The other is that the obvious gathering together of employees and employers under the umbrella of PERS pretty strongly implies that a pool of liability coverage is created, but also a pool of responsibility to cover unfunded contingencies. So I would urge folks to look at the Lipscomb decision, look at the PERS subsequent actions, and I think those two things will make folks conclude that when there are contingencies that cannot be met in any other way, they will be socialized. So it's sort of a logical progression. Our job, I think, as a committee is to put such strong sideboards around this issue, this particular issue, that it doesn't become a precedent, but also to recognize that there are circumstances under which the contingency fund would be accessible. So, just two things that inform the committee's discussion.
All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Roberts, did you have another question?
Well, I just want to state, Mr. Chair, that PERS has some culpability in this, and they don't have money to pay their culpability, so it kind of has to be shared by everyone in the system who really should have contributed to the contingency fund but haven't. So that's kind of how we came to that conclusion.
Mr. Right. Chair, if I may, I understand and agree with the comments from Senator Ferriola and Senator Walker. I just feel, though, as well, that we need to strike a balance between both employer and PERB responsibility. To the extent that there is foreseeability and accountability, to avoid that contingency so that the contingency reserve isn't tapped unnecessarily. And I think that's what Senator Walker just said.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Roberts, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to comment. All right. Okay. And I'm taking by your comments that you're at least reasonably satisfied with this
yes.
agreement.
Yes,
all right. Thank you. On this particular issue, we're going to come back at 5 p.m. today, and hopefully we'll have a draft that everybody's satisfied or not, and then we'll come back 8:30 Friday morning, assuming the legislature is still in session. Okay, so we'll close the work session on House Bill 78. We're going to go, Senator Ringo, are we ready to talk about 3544 or not?
People that were looking at the draft that we just prepared all seemed to be on board with it. But it was their first look. And I could go get Doug McKean to walk the committee through it. Essentially, he just took the same language and I think put it in a different order to make it flow better. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to bet you that if you reschedule this for this afternoon, then the draft version would be in a final version. We could pass it out.
All right. And we'll do that. We'll bring 3544 back at 5 p.m. And hopefully have a final version for that. 2237, we're not going to get to. It's not yet ready. 2498, let's do a little discussion on 2498. Interest rate unchargeable. Senator Ringo, you had some interest or some amendments that were...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, to me it just doesn't make sense that one set of judgments should have one interest rate and other judgments have another interest rate. And if there's a certain cost of money that ought to be applied to outstanding judgments, and that applies whether it's a medical malpractice judgment, a tort judgment, a contract judgment, a family law judgment, and the amendment that I drafted would apply across the board. And it would lower the current rate from 9% to about 5%, and it would float once a year. Some people don't like that because they think 5% is too high, and some people don't like it because they think 5% is too low. And maybe that means it's an appropriate balance. Certainly you can't satisfy everybody when they've got opposite interests on what the interest rate should be. But I think philosophically and as a matter of fairness, one rate ought to apply.
And which amendments are yours to reflect? 88 or 89?
I believe it's the 88. 88,
okay.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ringo.
That would be the
88. 88, okay. So yours would float once a year, he said.
Every January 1st, it would float based on the federal funds rate.
Now, is that all judgments?
All judgments.
Okay.
The trickiest issue has to do with outstanding family law judgments for child support, because when those are unpaid, they're considered new judgments. And so there's some question as to what is the easiest way to calculate those if they're constantly shifting.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to some family law folks on this, and whether this is the best way to go. I mean, frankly, they would prefer just to have an exception for them and stay at 9%. That's what they would prefer. But I don't think this poses much of a burden to change once a year.
All right. And then we have the A9 amendments. These are the ones that I've requested stay out of the draft.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. This is basically the returning to the original House Bill 2498 that was in the House, so that the rate of interest on judgments is limited to professional negligence of a doctor or nurse, and then would have it as the lesser of 5% per year or 3% in excess of the discount rate in effect at the Federal Reserve Bank in the Federal Reserve District where the injuries occur. So
those are the two concepts that we have present for 2498. It is also not ready to move, lacking constitutional problem. So we're not going to be able to get to that. Doug, we're going to come back at 5 p.m. on 3544.
Okay.
So we'll have some time to try to get those in final form. So that, I think, should be done.
Yes.
Thank you. So we'll recess the 5 p.m.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm
And let me see. I want to make sure. Do we have anybody in the room for 9:46? Senate Bill 9:46.
No one on the sign up.
Would you call Senator Westland's office just to make sure that he's been notified?
I like him.
But let me go then to 2278, work session of House Bill 2278. We have dash 16 amendments. You want to address these or do you want? Right, correct.
Craig.
How about, is Mr. Hendricks in the room? You want to come up and talk to us about the dash, the B-16 amendment?
Chairman, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. The dash B-16 amendments that you have in front of you have two pieces to it. One is the long-term fix, and that is takes you all the way back to page 7. That is the long-term fix is the piece that all parties have always agreed was a necessary thing to do to try to prevent the fire district 10 problem from ever arising again.
That is line 4, section 7.
It's starting from the first page, section 160, all the way down to page 7, okay, to the end of 165. That's the long-term fix, which says that if you have another situation where you have transferred employees or merging entities or consolidating entities, that they have to address the liabilities of or PERS that are outstanding. And if they fail to do so, PERS is authorized to administratively determine who is going to pay. So if you fail to address it now, you do it at your own risk.
All right. Good.
The one thing I should mention on that is at the meeting this morning, there was discussion about trying to do a fix on so-called Chapter 190 entities that are created by intergovernmental agreements. I did not have time to do that today. I've talked to a few people, and they feel that that's probably something that can wait. We may look at it yet another bill this session that will be coming back from the Senate, but it does not appear in this bill. And it may not. The more I've learned about it, it sounds as though it may be a bit a more narrow problem than we first thought, because the problem that PERS currently have, which is a very small problem compared to the Fire District 10 problem, we're talking about a very small amount of unfunded liability, arose from an agreement that was entered before Chapter 190 was amended, specifically to say that when entities create one of these bodies, they have to address in that agreement that forms it how the debts for the entity are going to be addressed in the event that the entity ceases to exist. So hopefully, long term, we have addressed the problem of the dissolution of a Chapter 190 entity, but so we'd only be looking at probably older situations anyway. Now, for the Fire District 10 problem, Section 167 that shows up on page 7 is the language that reflects the agreement that was discussed this morning. What 167 does is indicate that the board is going to allocate to the City of Portland 21.8743% of the actuarial liability that currently exists for Fire District 10. That figure translates from the figures we currently have to approximately $15.5 million. Now, that number is at best a rough estimation based from a year and a half ago, and it could have changed. It may very well have gone down because of things that have happened since that time, but it's the best. It's the best way we've got to divide it up at this point. The other 78% of the liability that's attributable to the Fire District 10 employees is going to be, quote-unquote, socialized. It's going to be made a liability of all employers in the system.
What percent was that?
It's 78%. It's roughly 22% to the city of Portland, 78% to the rest of the employers in the system. What that means is, and I should tell you, the original draft and the original proposal was to assign that to the contingency reserves. PERS, I had shipped the language over to PERS this morning. They responded, and they felt that it was an unnecessary complication to put it into the contingency reserve, that they would rather just treat it as any other liability of the employers that will have that impact on their contribution rates, but that it was not necessary to put it to show a negative charge in the contingency reserve.
Okay.
Subsection 3 says that Fire District 10 is going to pay $50,000 towards these liabilities. It indicates they'll have to have a payment schedule set up by PERS, and the payment schedule will be on the same, no longer than the normal amortization rate for employer liabilities and PERS, which I believe is currently 25 years. So they'll have a long time if they decide to work out a payment schedule of that length. More likely than not, if Fire District 10 disappears in a couple of years, it will be because they'll merge with one of the other surrounding entities, and I would hope that at that point a $50,000 liability would not be a significant impediment to them linking up with someone else and merging them with another entity.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that was my question in advance of my question, which is if Fire District 10 does merge or dissolve itself, that liability is going somewhere, correct?
Yeah, correct. I think that if it dissolves, it raises that interesting question of insolvency.
Right.
But again, I would think the most likely result for Fire District 10 is that it is absorbed by one of these entities or more than one, and I would hope that as part of that arrangement they would assign that liability among them. $50,000 probably is not quite. $75 million would have been a hard one to deal with an absorbing entity, but $50,000 hopefully would not be a huge impediment to them splitting up or merging with one of the other entities. Subsection 5 is the provision that assigns additional responsibilities to the other entities who took on portions of Fire District 10. They are basically, the board is told to figure out what the impact on the contribution rates of this socialization is.
That's right.
And the other four cities that are involved, Gresham, Fairview, Wood Village, and Troutdale, will pay twice whatever that impact is for so long as the liability exists. So they've taken it on for as long as it takes to pay off all the liabilities that may be applicable to these particular service by these particular employees. And I wanted to repeat for Senator Ferrioli, we didn't get a chance to do the Chapter 190 fix we talked about, but it looks like it may be something that can wait. We may try to address it in another bill, but it won't show up in these amendments.
The only question I have, I thought Senator Ferrioli may be able to help me with this. I thought Portland was going to do four times the percentage.
0.5, Mr. Chair.
Is that represented in these?
The rough estimate we've been playing with for the cost to the system generally, to system employers in generally, is 0.05% of the their salary base. The policy decision reflected here was that the city of Portland, since they're going to pay $15.5 million of this total cost, would pay the same as any other employer would pay, 0.05. The other four cities that are not making any sort of, aren't taking on liability for any of the like $15 million, are being asked to pay double that 0.05. For a 0.1% increase in employer contribution rate.
Right. Is that consistent?
Yes, it's absolutely consistent.
All right.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm expecting a chorus of approbation sounding much like the Alleluia chorus shortly after this is vetted to the committee from the participants.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anybody that feels compelled to come up and testify on this issue?
You could all raise your hands and say hallelujah.
Actually, nodding heads would probably suffice.
All right. We're in work session. We've got the B-16 amendments that have just been explained to us.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
With great thanks to Senator Farioli, who I think is really, and Senator Walker, who have done a wonderful job brokering this, I would move the dash B-16 amendments to House Bill 2278.
All right. Great. Senator Burdick now moves the adoption of the B-16 amendments to House Bill 2278. Is there any discussion? Any objection? No objection. Motion passes. Council, do we have any other amendments that we're aware of here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we already adopted on that bill the A6s, which dealt with the unit captions of the original bill, and we also adopted the A12, which was the DCBS technical housekeeping. So we already got those adopted.
All right. The unit captions also appears in the dash, the B-16 amendment. I assume that they're the same.
Mr. Chair,
sorry,
I noticed that.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure with Mr. Hendricks, we can make it clear that the unit captions deals with which sections. It's my understanding that was meant to go to the large bill, and that was the one that had unit captions, so we'll make it clear when these are combined that the portion that deals with unit captions will go to the district's portion. Is that correct?
Chairman, members of the committee, committee council, actually this is for the whole bill. The whole bill's got, and we had slipped when we printed the bill, we didn't have this section, so we wanted to make sure it got in there because, you know, the unit captions are the things that, like on the first page where it says unfunded PERS liabilities,
okay.
We always want to make sure that these things don't become part of the law because okay. Otherwise we're stuck with them forever. So and we should have had that on the original bill. So we tacked that on to the amendments to make sure that it got on.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Burdick.
I think as a technical matter, I would like to move that we delete the dash B-6 amendments. House Bill 2278.
The A6?
The B6. All right. So, just for the record, then, Senator Burdick moves that we delete the B6 amendment we previously adopted, which is the unit caption.
Because, it's already covered by the B16, so it will be redundant.
We probably didn't need to do that.
Any discussion? Any objections to that motion? Hearing none. Ordered. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I move this gigantic bill, House Bill 2278, as amended.
All right, Senator Burdick now moves House Bill 2278 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Ringo, sir.
I just want to thank Wendy Johnson and Oregon Moffin for such good support on the bill with such a good relating cause. Thank you for being patient.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate the work of the subcommittee. I do appreciate Wendy being ever vigilant, trying to follow her bill through this process. It's been interesting. So with that, is there any other comment or opposition? Any
Mr. Chairman, just another comment. I think Mr. Hendricks' work was extraordinary. Did it quickly, cleanly, and in an expeditious manner.
I do appreciate that, Mr. Hendricks. Thank you.
Very nice to have that kind of competence.
Is there any objection to the motion?
As well as
comments?
Mr. Boyko, Mr. Delaney.
Well, they still have to stand in the corner for a number of hours.
What a mess it was created by their predecessor.
Exactly.
Okay. There. No further comment? Any opposition? Opposition? The motion passes. That Senator Farioli and Senator Walker carry the bill.
Yes, sir.
We did it.
So thank you very much. The bill is gone. Now we're not going to deal with 2237 or 2498 until those two are not quite ready yet. We'll go to House Bill 3544.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, 3544 is the wage bill we were talking about earlier, the one we had Doug McKean here on. And we now have what Doug McKean came and introduced as the rough draft. We now have is the A13, so I want to make sure that on 3544 you have the A13. And Senator Burdick reminded me that this will supersede what we already did earlier. We had already adopted the A2, A3, A6, and A9. You'll recall, hopefully, that Senator Ringo thought we could make the amendments a little bit clearer that Doug McKean did to deal with simultaneous firings, and the A13 is that. So if we're going to adopt the A13, as Senator Burdick reminded me, we should delete the others. I also gave you a letter, several letters actually, from Boley, Christine Hammond, her support for the A13s, the policy reasons behind the language that we have in the A13s. I'll point out what they're talking about. You may or may recall is on page 2, lines 21 through 25. This is the language that makes it clear that we're dealing with penalties for not giving wages to employees, and what the Boley letters are focusing on is that there is a limitation on the penalties that this section would say does not apply, and that is if the employer has violated ORS 652, 140, or 145 one or more times in the year before the employee's employment ceased, or the employer terminated one or more other employees on the same date that the employee's employment ceased. In those situations, the limitation would not apply, and you have the letters from Boley and a letter from there's one from Dan Gardner from July 30th in his support and of these amendments. And I think I attached these because there was some question about the policy behind that. So that brings that up to date.
All right, great. A13?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just a comment. I would like to thank Legislative Council Budget Team for improving what was, I think, a real mess. And he didn't change that. He didn't change very many substantive words. All he did was reorder them and change how they're organized. And I think it's an improvement.
All right. You're in work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move that we delete the dash A2, the dash A3, the dash A6, and the dash A9 amendments in House Bill 3544.
All right. Senator Burdick moves that we delete the A2, A3, A6, and A9 amendments that we previously adopted. Is there any objection? Objection. Motion passed. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve the dash A13 amendments to House Bill 3544.
Senator Burdick now moves that we adopt the A13 amendment to House Bill 3544. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3544 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick now moves. House Bill 3544 is amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections to the motion? No objection. The motion passes. Thank you very much. And do I have a volunteer? Senator Starr, would you want to carry this one? Senator Starr?
I was thinking Senator Ringo, since he was...
Oh, yeah, that's right. He's the guy. I'll give you one of these next. Is that okay? You want to do it?
Be glad.
You can talk about...
I still really don't know what it does, though.
Mr. Chairman. Since we're complimenting good sports around here, I would like to compliment Bureau Fuller for being a very good sport.
Yes.
The things that his bill was used for, almost used for, and ultimately not used for, et cetera, et cetera.
Modest stuff. All right. I'm going to move to Senate Bill 946. It's a public hearing. Anybody here on 946? Nobody's here. Council, tell us what this bill does.
Mr. Chairman, this bill deals with provisional driver's licenses, and let's see, where is my copy of the bill? This bill, Senator Westland, as you know, there's a provisional driver's license for kids that are 15, and we've created in law situations where such a person cannot drive with other people, and in this we create an exception to that says... if there is a person in the vehicle who has a valid driver's license and who is the parent or step-parent of the holder of the license, then that is an exception to the provisional license requirements. So if you look at page 1, line 7, this is the provisional license where for the first 6 months after issuance of the license, the holder of the license may not operate a motor vehicle that is carrying a passenger under 20 years of age who is not a member of the house of the holder's immediate family. For the second 6 months, the holder of the license may not operate a vehicle that is carrying more than three passengers who are under 20 years of age and are not members of the holder's immediate family. And for the first year after the issuance of the license, the holder of the license may not operate a motor vehicle between the hours of 12 midnight and 5 a.m. And we are creating an exception to that.
Okay, only current exception is?
It's currently we have the only broad exception to that is subsection 1 does not apply to a holder of license who is 16 or 17 years of age and who is operating a motor vehicle with an instructor.
So right now the only exception is with an instructor.
Correct. And then there
or if your passenger is under 20 and they're a member of your immediate family.
Okay, the parents can't be there.
Oh, I helped write this bill.
You did?
Yeah, in a 99 session. I can't believe we overlooked that.
So it does look like a bit of a glitch.
Well, it's a big glitch. But why would we limit it to just parent or step-parent? What about grandparents? I would say a member of the person's immediate family. What if it's an older brother or sister?
I don't know. Senator Weston's not here to defend himself.
That's a good point.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We presented the bill to the committee. We'll get a hold of Senator Weston tomorrow. Let him know he had a public hearing on his bill. And if you want to make an amendment, move forward. How do you feel about Senator Walker's discussion here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're really getting close to the end
yes,
here. I would want to send this out. And if we want to add people to the list.
It is a Senate bill.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to send this out today.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's clearly we have dispensed with hearings on Senate bills in the House.
Yeah.
So really, you don't have to worry about it. Just run.
That's a little poke, I think.
Good point.
Okay.
So,
Senator Walker, would you?
Well,
I
don't want to step on Senator Weston's toes, but I truly think that that needs to be fixed, and I guess he can make a fix and have it ready when it gets over to the House.
There you go.
And arrives DOA, because they're not hearing any bills, but maybe they will, because he's a recent former member. So I will make that recommendation.
Work
to
session,
Senator.
946.
Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Let's
get it over there.
Come on, this tiny dive fever has gotten to me.
Mr. Chairman, I've learned never to argue with the Senator Burdick after she's been drinking, so you better listen to what her motion is.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 946, unamended, to report the Senate of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so what? One more bill. Who? Senators. What's the silence to Senator Weston? How about that? Okay, well, he can explain himself.
Mr. Chairman, before you adjourn,
Senator Weston, one more bill.
Okay.
Yes.
In the interim, between the
there you're buzzing,
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to go back just for a moment to an issue on House Bill 2278.
And, yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank Mark Ellsworth for his work
yes, facilitating
oh. that meeting because he was essentially a go-between between PERS and the committee. He rounded up the committee
and
two or three times, met with you and other members of our little sub-working group.
Right.
I just wanted to acknowledge that he did good work and that really benefited from having that facilitation done.
I actually appreciate it because actually staff to the General Government Committee and I stole him. And Senator Corcoran allowed it, so that's good news for us.
I just wanted to acknowledge that for the committee and for the record.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to move now to a public hearing. I'm not the chairman anymore.
No, you're not. You just killed your own. Fine.
We're doing a...
Born under a bad sign, Mr. Chairman.
This is a work session on Senate Bill 737. The member should have a letter from the governor. The governor's office came to me requesting that we do something with this bill, and I suggested to the governor's office it would be a good idea to have something indicating that they supported the bill. And then we've got some folks from the Oregon State Police to come talk to us about it. And I think the issue here is the loss of about $1.5 million in burn grant money if we don't comply with the federal law. You gentlemen want to come up briefly? Correct anything I've said that's inaccurate or even close to it.
Oh, we haven't heard this bill since March.
Go ahead, sir. Introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Lieutenant Bob Sundstrom, manager of the Major Crimes Section of Oregon State Police. With me is Dan Malin. He's the manager of the Sex Offender Registration Unit.
Okay.
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, if you recall, back in March when we held the hearing, we testified in support of the bill. The bill had three basic pieces to it. Supervising agencies would register their clients for sex offender registration. Registrants who attend school or work on or change their jobs would have to do a registration to reflect that fact, which is tied to the Federal Campus Sex Crimes Prevention Act. And the Oregon State Police would develop a rule as to what identification a person would have to bring to confirm their change of address registration. We supported the bill in all three pieces. Oregon State Police continues to do approximately 61% of the registrations in the state, and we agreed with the sponsor of the bill that supervising agencies could certainly register their clients. We greatly pushed for the registration of offenders who work on institutions of higher education or attend institutions of higher education because of the federal amendment to the Wetterling Federal Sex Crimes Act and the tie to the potential loss of the Byrne grant funding. To that end, we initially drafted a bill, which was Senate Bill 176, never heard, that just outlined the requirements of the Campus Sex Crime Prevention Act, and they are not quite as broad as the requirements in this bill. This bill requires registration for all school changes, which could include juveniles, and for all job changes. Whereas the Federal Sex Crime Prevention Act only required those on a campus of higher education.
Great.
So we still support the bill, Chair Minnis, and we're glad we had another opportunity today to come down and provide that to you.
All right. Thank you. Questions? The question is whether the committee supports moving the bill or not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess your statement about the bill is broader than is required. So if we narrowed it down to apply just to higher education, we would still qualify for the money, right?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, that's correct. If we narrowed it down, I'm sure that we would still meet the Federal Department of Justice's requirements for that amendment to the Wetterling Act.
Okay.
Senator Rico.
Does this bill have a fiscal associated with it?
Yeah, loss of $1.5
million. No, on the other side. Why not?
Well, actually, what it may do, and you can speak for yourself, but it actually may save you guys money, because currently you register the vast majority of these votes.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, I think at the hearing back in March, there was some discussion of workload increase on the part of representatives from the corrections community. So even though they didn't identify direct fiscal impact, they did testify as to that workload increase. For the Oregon State Police, it may save us some workload as far as registrations are concerned. If the bill was passed to meet just the Federal Sex Crimes Prevention Act, we estimated that that would result in an increase in 80 to 100 registrations per year, which would be a minimal impact. The way the bill is drafted now with registrations for all school and employment changes, we estimated that that could be 800 to 1,000 registrations, and that could create a significant impact workload across the state, not just for Oregon State Police, but for all registering agents.
And you're referring to the bill as it's currently drafted?
The bill
800 to 1,000
as
registrations per year.
Yes, Senator.
And that would have increased workload, at least on the state, but also on the local corrections departments.
That's correct, Senator.
Mr. Chair, just a couple more.
Can you refresh my memory? What needs to happen for somebody to get removed from this sex crimes list? When there's a procedure and then they're on it for life, isn't that right?
Chairman Minnis, Senator Ringo, that's correct. Right now, current state law for an adult convicted sex offender, an opportunity for them to petition for relief from registration is made available if they were convicted of one sex crime only, of C felony or below, 10 years after the end of their supervision. They can petition the circuit court in the county where they reside for relief.
And there's a window of opportunity, and if they don't petition during that window, then they've lost the opportunity forever?
No, the way the statute reads is they must wait at least 10 years before they can petition.
Right.
There's no closure to that window that I'm aware of. Anytime after, 10 years after supervision, they can petition. There's windows of opportunities for juveniles, but that was taken care of in this legislative session as well with House Bill 2756.
Do you have numbers as far as what percentage of people on the sex crimes list are predatory?
For the predators at Oregon State Police monitors, those who are off of supervision, right now there are about 200 predatory sex offenders in the state. The individual county parole and probation offices or community corrections offices, they have their own number they're supervising that they directly supervise. That's probably about another 200. There's probably about 400 in the state, Senator Rico.
That you consider predatory?
Let's say the criminal justice community as a whole considers predatory.
And then in addition to those 400, there would be many registered sex offenders that would not be considered predatory but would be subject to each reporting requirement.
That's correct, Senator Ringo. Right now we have approximately 10,600 registered sex offenders in the state.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I guess just a comment. I mean, the gentleman said Oregon has 10,600 registered sex offenders in the state.
Most of them in port.
All of them. And maybe, and perhaps 400 would be considered predatory. So essentially, we're going to be keeping track of this for 10,000 people whenever they change jobs or try to get schooling. And I understand that the rationale is we need to get federal money, but there are times we decide not to jump through hoops for the federal money.
Right.
And I'm not convinced that we shouldn't do this at times.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I hear the argument. To put it in context, you could ask yourself how many Oregonians have a Social Security number where we have to keep track of them every time they change jobs. All. Virtually. So I don't see the burden is on the applicant, the burden is on the registrant, the burden is on the offender to register. And other than being the recipient of that registration, or possibly providing some prosecutorial assistance if the registrant doesn't meet the requirement, I don't see that it creates a great deal of burden. And I would imagine that during the next 2 years, well, 16 months, the agency will advise the legislature if they need relief.
Actually, the bill eliminates some existing confusion right now, because I know when I've registered sex offenders, when you read the form, it makes, if you read it wrong, it almost sounds like you do have to currently comply with the school and employment related changes, but that really only applies to people living outside of the state of Oregon. This brings everybody, I think, on a level playing field, if I'm not mistaken.
Chair Minnis, leading up into this legislative session, we have had some recommendations made by field agencies concerning potential changes to the back of that registration form, which we are going to put in place after all the session is completed.
Good. I was thinking about just tape recording it and playing it back to people. Here's what I told them. All right. Where are we?
Well, I have a question. Do we have an amendment, or is this the original bill?
It's the bill.
Well, I'm looking through my notes, and Daryl Baker from Clackamas County Parole and Probation, he was a supervisor, is probably still. Opposed is currently written, creates two different processes. Makes community corrections the registering agency, not law enforcement. That was what you got in a tiff with him about.
Because it's not accurate.
Boy, there were some people who did not like this bill.
Yeah.
All the parole and probation people didn't like it.
Governor liked it.
Well,
yeah, why was this held
up
for so long?
Because I killed it.
This is the prerogative of the chair.
We wouldn't be doing this if the governor's office had kind of been said, if you please.
And we're doing this simply because Mr. Ashcroft has passed down another edict that we got to do this, or we lose money.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. As much as I'd like to draw federal politics into this issue, because there is federal money that would be coming.
And these poor guys are stuck in a
hole. This is not an Ashcroft versus Oregon issue. This is whether or not we're going to fully participate in this program and meet the federal requirements.
But I'm supporting my governor. I like calling this an Ashcroft program. All right. Would anybody move the bill to the floor of the Senate?
Chairman, I'll move Senate Bill 737.
Senator Birdie moves Senate Bill 737 to the floor of the Senate. With reservations or due pass recommendation?
Due pass recommendation.
Or due pass recommendation. Discussion? No. Beyond what we already have. Any objections? Hearing none. Senator Ringo objects. Motion passed. Thank you. God bless you.
Yeah, so I'm not going to
be a fast gavel there.